Good morning. It's the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. And on the second Monday of every month, we bring in a tech expert to answer all of your tech questions, such as, what should I do if my electronics become waterlogged? Quick story about the first Monday of this month, last Monday, which was our first day back from the holidays on the Larry Mueller Show. A member of our team who shall remain nameless packed all their papers, lunch, water bottle, and WPR-issued MacBook Air laptop computer into their backpack and made their way to work. Somewhere along the way, their water bottle lid popped off, soaking their papers, lunch, and WPR-issued MacBook Air. They could see water sloshing around inside their computer screen. A panicked search on their cell phone suggested they try to dry it out by turning the laptop upside down in the shape of a tent. When they tried to turn it on, the MacBook Air made short squealing noises like it was in pain. Needless to say, this embarrassed, nameless member of our team now has a new WPR-issued MacBook Air, as well as a new leak-proof water bottle. And with that, with us now is Jesse LeGrew, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. He's here to answer your questions and more at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email anytime, talk at WPR.org. And Jesse, welcome back to the Larry Mueller Show.
Glad to be here.
So let's start with waterlogged electronics and what you can do to try to save them. If you spill water or some other liquid like coffee on your laptop computer, how does that affect the inside?
Yeah, so usually with any kind of spill, it's hard to know what's going to happen. It does depend, is the device turned on when the spill happens? Even if it's attempted to be turned on while it's wet, if it wasn't turned on before, any kind of electronics where things, you know, energy is actively flowing in the system, and water, you know, they don't mix. So it could cause a lot of different components to break. And usually when there's any kind of spill, it's pretty risky in terms of, you know, whether this device is going to work again in the future. It's really hard to know, but spills, electricity and water do not mix very well. And so it's always a challenge.
Would this nameless member of the Larry Mueller team been more fortunate had it been a cell phone as opposed to a laptop?
Actually, it's very likely, yes. So newer cell phones tend to at least have some better protections if they are in either a moist environment or potentially even submerged. So a lot of new cell phones, you do get some protections. You might also have that from a cell phone case itself. But just due to the nature of cell phones, a lot of manufacturers have made cell phones a little bit more what they call water resistant, not waterproof. So it's not that any water will not affect it, but some moisture being even submerged in a small amount of water will not damage the device, whether it's turned on or turned off. So a cell phone, you're probably a little bit safer. Most laptops are generally not going to survive being turned on and submerged in water. That being said, there are manufacturers that create electronics that really are meant to be underwater. So depending on what you're looking for, you could potentially find that. That being said, it's also going to be more expensive. So you're going to be paying for that premium device that might be able to hold up better with water or just other environmental challenges, whether that's cold, heat, anything else. So you can find it, but it's usually a very specialized market, and usually you're going to pay a little bit more for that.
Sadly, MacBook Airs do not appear to be one of those devices. But what about the idea of turning it upside down in the shape of a tent and see if you can get some of the water out that way? Would that potentially have worked had it not been so waterlogged, or was that likely a lost cause from the outset?
You know, you never know until you try. I've seen a variety of devices damaged, not just spilled on, you know, thrown into a pool, run over by a vehicle. Things do happen. And sometimes you'd actually be surprised with the devices that remain functional. Usually with anything that's wet, the biggest item is to try to let it dry. Try not to touch it. I would, you know, any chance where the water can move around is one of those times where, you know, that that motion can connect, you know, a circuit that might be energized that creates a different issue. So anything you can do to dry it up and not turn the device on is going to be helpful. Usually for most devices, one of the recommendations is going to be, unplug the battery and then allow it to dry for a certain period of time. And then, once you're relatively certain it's dry, you can try to turn it on, or you could even try other mechanisms to try to get data off. In the end, it's challenging these days because a lot of the laptops you get, you can't take the battery out.
Right.
So you're kind of guessing in terms of, is it safe enough to try to turn on? Because if there's still a little bit of water and you try to turn it on, that could be the moment. Maybe it wasn't broken before, right? It was just wet. But the time you hit that power, maybe that's going to be the moment that, you know, the wrong thing happens and the device damages itself and renders itself unusable.
Try to dry it out before you even give it a chance of trying to turn it back on. Sounds like a good plan. Yep. Jesse, I had always heard that where one of the other, maybe it's a good rule of thumb or maybe it's just a myth, is to keep a bag of uncooked rice around. And if you perchance your electronic got wet, you could drop it in a bag of rice and that would help dry it out.
Yeah, usually anything that can help to soak in moisture is going to be useful. Another thing people recommend outside of rice is going to be what they call desiccant. So those little packets you get in a lot of electronics, they really are there to help keep things dry. So you'll see that in a lot of shipped electronics. You can actually buy those in bulk as well. And so you could try to put a device in any kind of area that will try to extract the moisture and put it somewhere else. Anything you can use could be helpful. Doesn't mean it's going to work, but it gives you at least a chance to try to dry things out to see if you can power that device back on.
You mentioned safety before, Jesse, about the safety of the computers, but what about my safety? Are there risks of shock when you're using electronics that have been damaged by water?
There's a possibility. It also depends on the device in terms of how much power is going to be output by the device. Usually with most of the laptops, that's at least not a concern I've had. That being said, if you have a certain device with a large amount of power, that could always be a risk. But most of the consumer laptops, cell phones are usually not going to be that much of a challenge. I wouldn't be at least as concerned. It's always something to think about in terms of what am I touching? Am I grounded? Where can electricity flow if it comes from one hand to another. So for anyone who's taken apart laptops or desktops and has needed to work with some of those components, being grounded, making sure you're working with those devices in a responsible way will help minimize any of those risks. But usually for the laptops, I haven't been concerned with the amount of power and whether I'm going to get a shock.
But anything that would be plugged into an electrical outlet that might be wet would be another story, whether it's your tech or anything else.
Most definitely.
Yeah. What about temperature? When we talk about some of these server farms and data centers that are being proposed, I know it is important to keep them cool. But in the winter weather like these, can there be such a thing as too cool for our electronics?
Any kind of extremes can cause issues, usually not too cool. I mean, if you're in a house, sometimes I kind of joke, if I have enough computers running, maybe I don't have to worry about turning on the heat. I think sometimes the cold can actually help the devices run a little bit better. But just like anything, if you get it too cold, things are going to be extremely difficult for the device. So there is going to be usually a threshold in terms of what's too cold and what's too hot. But if you do have a computer, it's going to react much better to colder weather than it is to much hotter weather. Because in the end, you are trying to really cool it down because it's generating its own heat. So if you're able to give it an environment that's already cooler, that might help it. But it does depend on all of the other electronics that are in your devices. One of the things to keep in mind, most of our newer electronics, there's not a whole lot of moving parts. Things are what we consider like solid state. So they're not moving. We don't have hard drives that are like spinning and being read. It's not always the case. But when you do have extreme temperature differences, different materials can contract and expand. And so that could be another issue where if you have a lot of temperature changes in short periods of time, that could cause other issues. But generally, you know, colder is nice. I think my computers like it a little bit cooler. They tend to run a little bit better. And, you know, they don't have to worry about, you know, overheating. I'm usually more worried about overheating than I am things being too cold.
How hot is too hot, Jesse?
Oh, that's a great question. So it always depends on the device. I would say if you're like an ambient temperature, if you're outside in 100 degree weather with a device, high humidity is probably going to be a little bit more risky because once again, that moisture can be a challenge. I think your device is probably going to have a difficult day. You'll notice it too if you have a cell phone, since we're lucky enough to have devices that have a lot of these mechanisms built into them. If you have your cell phone, let's say you put it on your dash in your car and you're driving around and it's a sunny day, you might look back at your phone to say, to see a message, it's been too hot. I'm going to stop functioning for you for a little bit and turn off. And sometimes you'll get that warning. Sometimes it'll actually turn off itself. So the nice thing is the devices can try to keep up and do what's necessary to save themselves. But being in the direct sun, anything that can make things hotter can be challenging.
Jesse LeGrue, our guest, he's the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, answering all our tech questions today at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Jesse, I am also curious about how to best clean my electronics, because when it comes to things like computer screens or my cell phone screen, you're not supposed to use any sort of Windex or anything like that on them. So what can you do to keep those screens clean?
Most people will just recommend microfiber cloths. Okay. You can get those in a variety of places. They're sold all over the place. And you can use that to basically just wipe clean any device. If you do, you could always use a little bit of water just to get any kind of smudges off. But yeah, they do recommend don't use like Windex or other thing, especially with the difference of screens. So a lot of screens really quite some time ago, so if you had an old what they call cathode ray tube or CRT display, right? It was a big TV looking thing. Right?
I used Windex on those back in the day.
Yeah, but they were glass. They were also a little bit different. And then when we started seeing more of these LCDs, they were not glass, right? They were plastic or some other kind of plastic components. And a lot of those materials really didn't work well together. Now, for some of the devices that might be using glass screens again, there might be more flexibility. That being said, the recommendation is still use a microfiber cloth. Wet it if you need to a little bit, wet the cloth and then, wipe as you need to on the screen. Most of the screens that I have these days, I could use a microfiber cloth. Most of the times if I have a cell phone, I can actually just kind of rub it on my shirt. It gets clean enough. So if you also have screen covers or screen protectors, that could help. It might make it a little bit easier to clean or protect it from scratches as well. So you have a few options. And if you do have different protectors, it might open up other options to clean it. But really, a microfiber cloth is all you should need.
That keeps it simple. When it comes to cleaning the actual electronics, do you get into your desktop computers? Do you use compressed air cannons or anything like that, Jesse?
Yes. Yeah. And actually, that can be kind of terrifying. So if you have a keyboard, especially the ones we get today might be a little bit more, compressed in terms of what can get in and underneath the keys. But I remember with larger keyboards, you can actually pop off the keys, which if you do have a larger keyboard where you can do that, a lot of people do recommend doing it. You can pop off the keys. You can let the keys soak because they're just plastic in most cases to get any kind of gunk off. And then you can actually clean underneath, which could be through like compressed air or something else. Some other keyboards might be a little bit, more challenging. You really can't take off the keys. Compressed air is great. Once again, make sure your electronics are turned off before doing it to get anything out. For people who do have desktops, it might be nice to open the case and actually spray out anything that's in there. I've seen a variety of devices that have had, spider webs, just dust,
mouse nests.
You'd be surprised. So a lot of things can get in there, but you'll also see, depending on the household too. So, I grew up in a smoking household. You will see different artifacts and things inside that case than you otherwise will. And so being able to spray it out is really handy. Having a compressor where you can actually spray it yourself is really handy. Otherwise, you can get those cans of compressed air. Just make sure you kind of keep it vertical when you're spraying it. But those will help get, you know, the dust out. When you get the dust out, that helps the fans run. When the fans are running, it helps the airflow. The airflow helps the cooling. So in the end, you're really trying to make sure, one, you know, maybe it's less gross, but two, especially if it's a device where you have fans and it's trying to cool itself down, getting any of the, like, the gook out of those areas will help your device cool down a little bit better, which actually might improve performance.
And this might be something you'd be able to do on your own with a compressed air can, or is this something you would take to a repair shop if you had questions about it?
You could do either. When I was assisting with computer repair, we actually did have a compressor in a closet. And so if somebody did bring it in, or we just noticed, hey, this is a little dirty, let's clean this out, bring it to the room, open it up, spray out anything you could, and, you know, go about your day. So I think you can bring it in somewhere. They might have some similar setup, or they might just recommend, hey, here's a can of air. Go ahead and open your case. I think the biggest item people would be concerned about is, you know, if I blow on something inside my case too hard, could something break? And I guess potentially, yes, I've never had that issue. Okay. And a lot of the components we use today are a little bit more resilient. They're also a little bit cleaner. We don't usually see a whole lot of cable messes inside of a device where things are kind of rattling around as much. So usually, you know, things are safe to, you know, blow it and get everything out without damaging it. That being said, you can always just, you know, move your hand further and further away from the case, right? The closer you are, the more of that force is coming directly to the device. So start going a little bit further away and get closer to just make sure you can get out any of that dust.
And maybe give your device a little bit extra life. Jesse LeGrew, our tech expert today for our Tech Expert Monday, answering your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Coming up at noon today, we'll take a look at fire safety in the home and uncover the history of the mafia in Milwaukee. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today on The Larry Mueller Show, and our guest this hour is Jesse LeGrew, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, answering your questions about your electronics, whether they're new from gifts this holiday season or whether you'd like to keep them going a little bit longer and as long as possible. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Or send us an email, talk@WPR.org. And Jesse mentioned taking perhaps your electronics into a repair shop. And one of the thoughts I always have is what kind of security considerations should I have in mind before I hand off my device to somebody else?
Yeah, it's a good question. There's a few things I usually think about when I'd want to give my device to anyone else. One, you know, is the device going to come back in working order, right? When I get it back, could something break? So making sure you have a backup if you can. Usually you're going into a repair area just because something's broken, but, you know, if things work enough where you can do backups, making sure you have a good backup to your data, I think that's important. You might be going to the repair area to actually have a backup done because you can't do it yourself. But make sure you have backups. And if you do have sensitive information that you might be concerned about, you might want to consider removing it. Now, usually you're going to an area for repair that you'd like to consider a trusted agent, right? They are someone you are trusting with your electronics and that are not going to be doing anything you know, malicious with your device or with your data. And so that's just a consideration I would put out there is if you're not quite sure, you know, in the end, you never quite know on the other end what's going to happen. So make a backup, remove sensitive information if you're concerned. Know really what state your device is in before you, you know, give it away. Kind of like a lot of the rules you think about when a rental car. Know what things and dents are there. Know what the fuel tank is. So when you get it back, it should be, you know, ideally in the same condition, if not better, because you're getting it repaired. So just know what you're handing it in. So when you get it back, it's what you intend. But I would really think about the things just like you would any kind of software or email provider you're using. In the end, the device, the data might be somewhere else. How much do you really trust the other end? And so just take that into account. Think about what works for you, I guess, for like your risk profile. Think about it before you drop it off, not after, because if something bad does happen, you don't have a whole lot to do after the fact.
I have a good email here from Nancy and Nina, who says, the end of Nancy's iPhone charging cord evidently got wet on the floor of the car after a snowstorm, which you could imagine would happen in Wisconsin. But plugging it into her phone results in a loud audio warning and a message that moisture was detected. She's waited 4 days now and has been using a wireless charger, yet no matter what charge cord Nancy now uses to attempt to charge her phone, she continues to get the warning. Is there anything she can do, or has she ruined the charger port to her phone, Jesse?
It sounds like since the alert's still happening, it's probably on the phone itself. So maybe there's a little bit of moisture is just still resident in the device that's causing that alert. A couple of things you can do is actually very similar to even if you had something like submerged in water. You could put it in rice. You could put it in a little box with a few packs of desiccant. You know, once again, those little weird plastic packages you hear that rattle around in your electronics, those are meant to suck away moisture. So trying to do that might assist with it. Otherwise, you could also, depending on where you received your phone, you might be able to go into a store and they could offer a recommendation or try something out for you. Normally, it sounds like you've tried a different cord, you've tried a different charger. If you've tried all those things and you're still getting the same message, it does make me think it's probably the phone itself. So I would try to do what I could to try to remove that moisture. And then if that doesn't work, you might want to consider going into a store to see if there's something else that might be done. I don't think in this case a software update or anything is going to fix it. So I think it's really just trying to make sure things are as dry as possible. Try to use a different charger, you know, a different plug and a different cable just to see if you do get a different behavior. I have had, at least in my Android phone, that pop up every, you know, so often if there is a little bit more moisture. Usually over time that message will go away. But if you are still getting it with different cables, it's hopefully you can get it dried out from your phone and it might just be, you know, giving it a little bit more time. Otherwise, yeah, you might want to go to a store.
The bizarre part to me is how it was the charging cord that got wet on the floor, but yet it was the phone that now seems to have the issue with moisture.
Yeah, and it might be that, and you know, depending on how much the end got wet, you know, if it's sitting on the floor and then that wet end, you're literally plugging into your phone, you're kind of transferring the moisture from the plug into the phone. And that's where you might be getting that message. The nice thing is, once again, our phones and devices are a little bit more resilient. So they're like, ooh, I'm going to find ways to detect moisture and, you know, limit the risk of any device issues. And so they have different sensors that will actually detect moisture and be able to do different things based upon where that moisture is. They also have those inside devices just to see if there was spill damage. But hopefully it's just maybe the moisture is so far up into the phone, it's just taking longer because you don't have as much airflow in order to get the moisture out. So it might just be helping it out a little bit and waiting a little bit longer to try to physical plug again.
Kathy from Oconomowoc emailed us. Her new left AirPod fell into the dishwater while she was doing dishes, and she did put it in a container of desiccants, and it does still work, but the battery doesn't last as long as the right AirPod. So is there anything Kathy can do to build up the battery on the left one, or is it a lost cause?
There's probably nothing you can actually do in order to get the battery to charge more. I don't know if there's like a reset process to try to recondition it. I would just keep on using it over the next, you know, few weeks and see if it changes, because maybe there is still a little bit more moisture. Maybe there's something else not allowing it to charge as fully. And so maybe over time it'll kind of repair itself. But I don't think there's anything actively you can really do to fix it if it doesn't really maintain that charge. You might not have a whole lot of options outside of replacing it.
Sorry, Kathy. Our producer, Clara Neipert, has a WPR issued Bluetooth headset that's about 4 or 5 years old now. I believe it's what she's using to screen calls with today. That is, when it works, because it's having trouble pairing with her new laptop. How can you tell when your headset becomes obsolete or if you're doing something wrong in the Bluetooth pairing process, Jesse?
That's a really good question. One of the challenges I run into is I use a lot of different devices. And so sometimes Bluetooth, it'll usually try to pair with the last device you use, which if you use multiple devices, it gets kind of weird because it pairs with the wrong device and you have to unpair it, disconnect it, repair it, or reconnect it with a new device. That's usually the first thing I take a look at when I have anything Bluetooth is what else is it trying to connect with? And can I simplify my life by disconnecting it or unpairing it with those other devices? Outside of that, if you're using the same device over and over, and it's really just between, let's say, your one laptop and your one set of headphones, it could be the laptop or the other device, because in this case, Bluetooth has to work on both ends. Mm-hmm. So it could be the device, not the headphones. And so try it with a different device, see if the behavior is better, because it could be a software issue as well. So it may not be the headphones, it could be software, it could be the Bluetooth module actually on the laptop or the other device you're pairing it with. So it goes now into the troubleshooting process of, is it the headphones or is it something else? And so try a different device, see if the behavior is better. If the behavior is better with a different device, you might want to take a look specifically at that other device your headphones are having an issue with, because it could be a software update or potentially another hardware issue that that device is having.
Makes me think of the list of Bluetooth devices in my car, which is a running list of all my old and now dead cell phones. That they're still there, even though the phones have long disappeared. I want to pivot now to some of the spyware that we're hearing about, because last month there were hundreds of people who received an alert on their cell phones warning that their device had been targeted by spyware. And it was just a few days later that both Apple and Google fixed these security holes that experts believed were being used to put malware on personal devices. How are we to, and some of these stories include what are now zero click spyware and malware, which means there is nothing you have to do wrong in order for them to get into your electronics. With this new wave of warnings and spyware being installed without us having to do anything, what can we do to protect ourselves, Jesse?
Yeah, there's a few things, and a lot of, I think we heard a lot of this over the last many years, really, with the Pegasus malware, which was a really good example of zero click. You just need to receive a text. You don't even need to interact with it in order for a device to get infected. In a lot of these cases, it's really a lot of significant investment to develop the tools in order to be able to do this. So usually it's targeted at smaller populations, because the more people that get it, the easier actually it is to find and to correct. So the more this spreads, in some ways it might actually get better, because the phone manufacturers and software developers will develop better protections for a lot of these things. That being said, if it doesn't exist, what do you do? The biggest thing, you know, and I'll recommend to everyone, is always update your device. So a lot of updates come out for devices regularly for feature updates, but also fixes for what they call a lot of these like zero-day vulnerabilities, in which you have 0 days to patch it, because, well, it's out there. People are using it. It's a vulnerability that is actively being used to get into people's devices and to get data. So update your device is always going to be good. If you can actually create, which is really challenging, kind of like allow lists for phone numbers that you would accept, that would include phone calls or text messages. If you know you're only getting trusted individuals into your phone, that will hopefully minimize the risk of any of those contacts or external contacts trying to, you know, infect your device with malware or something else. In addition, use your main app stores. So for iPhones, we have the App Store, and we have Google Play for Android devices. If you use that trusted App Store to install software, that being said, some of those software packages, could they be bad? It's possible. And so you also need to kind of think about, what am I installing? But if you are using third-party avenues to install software, that creates additional risk because a lot of the checks that happen through a lot of those providers are not happening either at all or in the same way that they are with those centralized providers. So try to use the trusted processes that are put in place to try to protect you and your devices, and be mindful in terms of what you're interacting with, who you're getting software from, who you're actually getting text messages from. And just like any device, I would say keep out for your device acting weird. And you might wonder, like, what does that mean? What is weird? And I would say it's anything that's not usual that you are anticipating. So lower battery life, if you see pop-up messages that you didn't have before, or just other things on your device that you wouldn't anticipate seeing. And sometimes those can happen from software updates because maybe things move around, colors change. But keep an eye for those things and know, is there something that could have happened recently that would have caused this? Because it's usually those unusual things that people notice, which could be an indicator of some kind of bad software or something just not working in the way it should.
Dang, Jesse, you just made me think of this. The Washington Post app on my cell phone has, and it's the only place it happens, has like a pop-up ad that asks if I want a snooze alert or something. It doesn't look like anything else in the Washington Post app. It doesn't appear to be an ad, and yet there's nothing I can do but click one of the options in this little black box. Only happens with the Washington Post. And so the only move I have to make is to close the Washington Post app to make it go away, because I'm afraid to click on anything because it does not look kosher.
Yeah, and for any of those items too, where you're not sure, well, is this the app? Is it potentially a bad ad, right? Mm-hmm. Something that is coming through a third party, because most of the times in a lot of our apps, on especially mobile phones, they're not all coming through an app. They're coming through a variety of third parties, especially if it's ad driven to, raise revenue for a variety of reasons. In that case, I would even start searching on the internet. Are other people seeing this? Is mm-hmm. this something that's standard? You might also be able to go back to the company that it basically paid for the app to be developed, whether they're doing it themselves or hiring somebody else to do it. Is this normal? Is this what I should be seeing? So some of that might need to be cross-checked with just information available online and what other people are seeing. The more that people actually put it out there and ask the questions, you actually get a little bit more confidence in terms of, well, other people are seeing it just because, and this might be normal. That being said, just because it's, usually seen doesn't mean that it's good. And so you still want to question, it seems like everyone else is noticing the same behavior, but really, should it be doing this? And what else can I do in order to get rid of this? In some cases, for some apps, it means paying money. In others, it might mean, not using the app or, using it in a different way.
What's the best thing I can do to find out whether or not my electronics have been infected?
Probably the best outside of, taking a look for unusual behavior is to kind of do a regular check of your device. Look at the apps you have installed. Is there anything unusual? Hmm. Part of this is kind of understanding too what's installed on your phone. A lot of, and people have limited time. They're not going to be like, I'm going to take a look at my phone every month and see what apps are installed and then cross-reference this to my spreadsheet to see if there's anything new or anything that changed. People don't have a lot of time for that, but if you're able to limit what's on your device and understand what's on your device, I think it helps out. That being said, many devices come pre-installed with a variety of software from your cell phone provider or other third parties like your device manufacturer that you may not be able to remove and that you just need to live with. So I'd say keeping kind of a self inventory is extremely helpful, looking up for those unusual behaviors and keeping things updated. Also, a lot of the zero click malware that has been coming around, some of those, and I don't know how exclusive this is, but many of those do not survive a reboot. And so if you just reboot your phone, you might be fine.
And again, those zero clicks are ones that you could install on your electronics through no fault of your own. You wouldn't have to do anything for them to enter into your system. And it's the basically the operating systems that are behind the scenes trying to prevent this. But if it's as simple as a reboot, well, that always seems to be the first thing that a tech expert would tell you to do when there's any trouble whatsoever.
Correct. And this might not work every time, but for a lot of the things that people had seen, especially with Pegasus, they didn't survive on reboot. If they do, which they usually call that persistence, but it remains. It may not be true all the time, but sometimes just rebooting your device, making sure it gets a clean startup. One, it'll allow the software to, a lot of them will do self-checks when it boots back up. But maybe if there is something weird running in the background, hopefully it will exit that and you'll at least start with a little more confidence that things are fresh and clean. It's not a guarantee, but it might help.
Nancy and Nina, we have an update for you. Now, Nancy's iPhone charger got wet, and now Nancy's iPhone says that she can't use that charging port anymore because of moisture that got inside it. Connie emailed to recommend that Nancy use canned air spray, which we've been talking about, the compressed air cans, to spray the charging plug of her phone because it worked for Connie. Well, maybe it'll work for Nancy and Nina, and thank you both for emailing us. Our guest, Jesse LeGrue, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Larry Mueller returns tomorrow, and his guest will be Dr. Zorba Pastor. Join Larry Mueller and Dr. Pastor tomorrow at 11 o'clock. I think they're on at noon. We're going to have patient advocates talking with Larry to start the show tomorrow at 11 o'clock. Right now, I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and it's our Tech Update Monday, answering your tech questions at talk at WPR.org or 800-642-1234, where Jack and Madison standing by. Jack, good morning.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I've got a Samsung phone, and when I try to plug in the power cord just to transfer files to my PC, it really doesn't work that well anymore. I have to jiggle it around, and it's very delicate. I don't know if it's just dirty, if I can clean it, or if it's damaged and needs to be repaired or replaced.
I'll ask Jesse here in a moment, but I've had this experience myself, and I think it ended up being pocket lint that was in the little port in my phone that had jammed in there, and I couldn't get the wire or the cable all the way in. So I had a little a plastic pick or something in there, or a little air cannon, got the pocket lint out, and I was able to reconnect that way. Jesse, what do you think?
Yeah, I think pocket lint is a good thing to take a look for. I also have a Samsung phone, but it's not just Samsung phones. I would try a different cable just to see if a different cable is better, especially the one in my car. It tends to fail after a certain amount of time just because of movement. But pocket lint is actually pretty common. Usually in the past, and I probably shouldn't use something metal, but if you have a really thin paperclip, can kind of get in there and like scoop out the paper, any of the lint. If you have good tweezers, that might help as well. But really anything you can kind of get inside, plastic, I think is going to be a good option if you have something small enough. So you can kind of get in there and just pull anything out. Over the years, I've actually been surprised at how much lint collection there. And if you do have a good amount of collection in there and you start pulling in there, like, wow, that's quite a bit. And all of a sudden everything works great. So you plug in your cable, it sits better. Like you can actually feel the difference when you plug in the cable. So pocket lint, yeah, it's definitely the first thing I would take a look at. But I'd also just try a different cable to see if the other cable works better. Cause sometimes, just the cables fail for a variety of reasons, whether it's, manufacturing defect or just, things moved in the wrong way at one time. And the only best way to fix it is to use a different cable. So those are probably the two main things, that lint probably being the first one to check out.
Jack, thank you for the call. And I have certainly been there with my ports. Don't forget to clean your ports carefully. I also wanted to ask you about, and I'm sure some folks got this for the holidays as a gift, smart vacuum cleaners, smart home devices, and the questions that about these smart devices, where the information they collect goes, and how we can make sure we stay secure as we add these Internet of Everything sort of devices to our homes, Jesse.
Yeah, and so this is, I wish I had an easy answer for this because oddly enough, so, and, you know, I experiment with a variety of, you know, home devices that will, you know, simplify life for you, right? You can check in your cell phone, even if you're at, you know, a restaurant or even out of the country. So it gives you a lot of capabilities to like manage things when you're completely remote. That being said, if things can talk to, you know, somewhere in the world, some data center, some centralized service, it means some of that data is leaving your house. And for robot vacuums, that could be your floor layout in terms of what things look like. Depending on the cameras, maybe it could be more information. So I think trying to limit some of the data being either collected centrally is going to be extremely helpful. It may or may not impact the usefulness of the device. So if the device doesn't have the internet, will it create an issue for actually using the device itself? If it does, you might have limited things you can do outside of getting a different vacuum. But if you're able to not connect it to Wi-Fi and keep things localized to just what it's doing in your house, I think that's helpful, especially if you're concerned with any other data it might collect. Usually a robot vacuum, I don't think would have a microphone, but if it does, I think that's a concern a lot of people have had with a variety of home assistants.
Well, I think baby monitors and things like that, that families rely on for their own security and safety, things that do have cameras and microphones and speakers, and how secure that information is and how susceptible they would be to hackers.
Right. And so anything you connect to the internet could have an issue with potentially, being accessed remotely, not to mention just that data being stored somewhere else. Even then, if you do have a provider for, let's say it's another example is a doorbell, right? You know, it's taking a look at the outside. Granted, it's public, but you might have audio, you might have video. Where is that data being stored? Even if you trust the company, it doesn't mean they might not have some kind of security intrusion, which means somebody else can get access to the data. So even if you trust everyone, you know, things happen. And so that data can go out there. So when, you know, picking all these options, it's really a choice. How sensitive do I feel the data is that you're collecting? Who's storing it? And am I comfortable with that?
Yeah,
and
you said, even if I trust the company, if I'm buying this device, why would I be suspect of the company that's providing it?
Right. And, you know, you might fully trust the company, but we've seen a lot of instances too where, you know, I generally trust the organizations that I work with, but I also know, you know, you're one click away from having a bad security day and somebody else having access to your information. Just like, you know, we think about the options and, you know, once again, these are not happening all the time, but they're constant risks out there. You have somebody that's working at the company that you trust. That individual, that engineer has a cell phone. They just had a zero-click text on their phone that infected their device, which they use to manage some of the you know, development repositories they use to manage the product that you have in your home. And so you start thinking about these little threads of how can somebody get into something. And there's a lot of ways. It doesn't mean being terrified of the world, but that there are, you know, reasons to consider not hosting information in different areas, or at least considering how risky is it if this data got out. And I think I'd recommend anyone using a lot of these services to really think about it, because I think it's likely going to happen, maybe, and I hope it's never with really sensitive information. But if this got compromised and, you know, landed on the front page of the paper, how concerned am I? Am I concerned about the general floor layout of my house being out there on the public? Probably not too much. And so for me, that would be reasonable, as long as I know, you know, there's no microphones, there's no other cameras outside of, you know, options to understand where there might be obstacles. And so doing a cost benefit on like that risk of that data is really helpful, because it at least lets you choose, yeah, I'm okay if that got compromised. It's totally fine with me. It's not of a big risk. So think about that with just about every product.
Talking about compromise, Keith emailed us. He says about a month ago, he began to hear from a bunch of people who had received an email from one of his Gmail accounts ostensibly sharing a folder, but Keith did not send that email, and that email address has a long, complicated password that probably could not have been hacked. Keith didn't share login info with anyone. The message went to some people he'd never emailed before, but may have been included in a message that was forwarded by another person, a third party. He has not talked to anyone who opened the folder or heard about any consequences if this happened. What if this happened to you, Jesse?
Well, there's a couple of things I'd take a look at. One, so if I thought it was my email account, I'd log in. Usually Google and a lot of other services will give you an option to see where you've logged in from. And so you can actually see, did someone access my account outside of me? So that's one thing I'd probably take a look into myself is, who else might have accessed my account? Was it really compromised? Because it might not have been. It could just be either like a falsified sender, or somebody sent this email in a different way. So it could just be a phishing email that had nothing to do with his account, but his account seemed to be part of it. Mm-hmm. At least it looked that way. Outside of that, I would ask some of the people who received the email, hey, can I get a copy of that? Because I'd be curious, what does it look like? Do I see it in my sent folder? Is the link that it's going to? Because it's very likely that link is not actually a shared folder that might expose data. It could be a phishing link that could either install malware, ask for data collections, or other pieces. So it might be a phishing email that could be something people just want to ignore. But I try to understand, did it really come from my account? Does anyone else access it? And do I need to protect it? Or did somebody just get a phishing email that...
Well, that seems to be likely, Jesse, because as Keith points out, the message went to some people he had never emailed before, but people who had may have been included in a message that was forwarded by another person. That other person could have been hacked or could have had access to their email accounts, found all the email addresses, and posed as them online?
Yep.
Interesting. And one more email before we're done here. Peter from Eden emailed us. He has an older router, a Netgear, and received a message from the manufacturer that he needs to upgrade his router for security and performance purposes. Peter wants to know, how necessary is this? Are they just trying to upsell Peter a new device?
So it could be serious. It could be a little bit of both. Netgear and a lot of other devices on the internet they're just trying to get attacked all day long by bots. So if you do have an out-of-date device, I do recommend, if you can't get software updates, you should consider replacing it. In addition, if you do have access to your router, one of the things that I would look for on any device is something they call UPnP, or Universal Plug and Play. Make sure you have that turned off. That will help at least with some of the device exposure and potentially exposure of any other services you might have on your home internet. But it is very likely your device is like end of life. You're not getting software updates, and you may need to upgrade in order to get the benefit. If you search for the model of your device, you'll likely get more information. It may also be in the email you receive from the manufacturer. But I do recommend try to have something that's up to date, especially if you have any publicly facing services you might be running from home that could impact your environment. So
I think my router had default UPP turned on. Can you go over that again briefly, Jesse?
Yeah, it's something called Universal Plug and Play. It's really something meant to allow you to access different services remotely. So it could be a NAS, network attached storage, or some other device. They might take advantage of it. The downside with having Universal Plug and Play, which is meant to make things easier for you, it might try to put something out on the internet you actually really don't want on the internet, which basically allows somebody to try to attack it remotely when otherwise they may not be able to. So if you don't have a service that needs it, or you're not sure, I would say turn it off. If you're like, ooh, this thing broke when I turned this off, it at least gives you something to research a little bit more. But generally, I would turn Universal Plug and Play off unless you have a really specific need.
Hope that helps, Peter, and thank you for the email. Jesse LeGrew, thank you as always to you. It sounds a little bit scary out there, but it also makes us sound like there are steps we can all take to make ourselves safer. So thanks again.
Looking forward to it next time.
Jesse LeGrew is the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. When we continue, we'll speak with a fire inspector with Eau Claire's Fire and Rescue about the things perhaps you can do to prevent the next tragic house fire. 'Tis the season, right now. So how can you keep you and your family safe? That's next. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. Larry's back tomorrow. You're listening to WPR News. Do you know what you'd do in the event of a fire in your home? Do you know what the rest of your family would do? How about your pets? I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and this is the Larry Mueller Show. And our next guest is Jason Knecht. He's a fire inspector with Eau Claire Fire and Rescue. And we invite you to our conversation with questions, or perhaps you have stories you can share that can help others. Or you can tell us about your family's fire escape plan. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org. And Jason, welcome to the Larry Mueller Show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
How long you been a fireman now?
Well, I started in 1990 on a volunteer basis in Altoona, Wisconsin, as an explorer. So it's been a little over 30 years now.
Yeah. What was it that made you want to be a firefighter in the first place, Jason?
Well, I grew up with it. My father was a founding member of the local volunteer fire department back in the 50s, and just grew up around fire trucks and, you know, dad responding to calls and stuff. So I guess it's in the blood.
Yeah. Having an opportunity to hang out at a firehouse, I noticed that meals in the firehouse are seldom actually served hot or warm. They're most often likely cold because the firehouse stays relatively busy with calls around the shift. Is that the same for you?
Yes. Just here in Eau Claire, we had about, it was just over 11,500 calls for 2025. So yeah, it's been very busy.
I'm doing the math there. That's a number of times every day that you're out on a house fire. And when it comes to going out on a call, what's that like for a firefighter? What's it like? Because you don't know what you're going to get until you get there, right?
Yes. Every day is different. I mean, that's one of the attractions to the job is that every day is not like the previous day. So there's always new challenges. There's always training. And it sounds like a cliche, but it is nice to help people on their worst day.
Yeah. That you step in and are there for folks when everything else is really going up in flames, quite literally. So we're talking to you today as the fire inspector at Eau Claire's Fire and Rescue because fires are most common this time of year, January, February, March. Why is that, Jason?
Well, it's a combination of things. Like we just got over the holidays. People during the holidays, when they have time off of work, they're home more. So that means they're cooking more. They're doing more activities at home. But now it's also winter time. So, you know, furnaces are being used more, space heaters, electric blankets, that kind of stuff. So just generally it's cold outside. So people are indoors more than they're out generally. And that tends to lead to some issues sometimes.
So the number of fire hazards increase considerably. What are the greatest fire hazards that people are most likely to look past or not see in their own home, Jason?
The biggest fire hazard would be the heating of the home and activities in the home. So, like, make sure your furnace is serviced. If you have a wood-burning stove, make sure your chimney is cleaned once a year. You know, don't go to bed with candles lit. Mm-hmm. That's a huge one. Don't overload your circuits. If you're going to use a heating blanket or you're going to use a space heater, make sure that the heating blanket is UL listed and that it's in good condition and the cord is in good condition. If you're going to use a space heater, make sure it's a recently manufactured space heater, that it has a tip-over switch. So if it tips over, it shuts off.
Is that a relatively common or recent feature, or is that something you have to look for that may cost a little extra but may save you a lot in the end?
No, it became a standard several years ago. I would say at least 15 years ago now. But there's still a lot of these older space heaters around. And don't use anything that uses natural burning fuels, like propane heaters indoors, because that produces carbon monoxide. Everybody knows that carbon monoxide will knock you out, and you know it's not good for you.
Indoors includes garages as well. I feel like that should probably be stated, right?
Absolutely,
yeah.
Yes.
So the steps that I can take, the ones that I always hear are, you know, your smoke detectors. And in your experience, Jason, as a firefighter, how important have smoke detectors been in helping save the lives of families and loved ones?
It is extremely, extremely important. For 2025, there were 57 home fire deaths in the state of Wisconsin. And three out of every five of those deaths did not have working smoke detectors in the home. I can't stress enough the importance of working smoke detectors. Make sure you have them, but then check them and change the batteries. You can buy detectors that have a 10-year battery, but the smoke detectors are going to be your first alarm to a problem. And the way things are manufactured nowadays with synthetic materials for furniture and carpet and wall coverings and things and all the plastic that we have in today's world, that burns so fast and so hot and makes very toxic smoke. So in a traditional house, you know, 30 years ago, you would have a few minutes to get out. Now, every second counts to get out. And those smoke detectors, if you have working smoke detectors, that's going to give you that previous announcement that there's a problem in the home.
Geez, Jason, I feel like I've been guilty of this in the past where the low battery alert starts going off and it's just so annoying that I'll pull the battery and not think about how vulnerable I'm making, not just myself, but my family and loved ones as a result. And it's just negligence. And feels lazy now that I think about it, and it's something I'm going to have to think twice about. And it seems to me it only comes up when we change our clocks, time to check your smoke detectors. But it also seems to me, if that's the case, that it could save three of the five lives lost in the last year from house fires, that we would be checking them more often.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that we use the change your clocks, change your batteries campaign because that's a good way to associate it with. And, you know, everybody does the same thing, you know, oh, this thing went off, or, oh yeah, I got to change the battery. I'll do that tomorrow. Or I got to, you know, and then you end up forgetting about it. Or sometimes they're placed wrong. Like they shouldn't be close to the kitchen.
Sure.
Not that you're a bad cook,
no.
Just that sometimes when you're cooking, they'll go off if it's too close, just like it shouldn't be too close to the bathroom, because a lot of times steam from a shower will set them off as well. So it's kind of like the boy that cried wolf.
Right.
They keep going off all the time. You're like, oh, this darn thing. And then you take it down. And then you don't replace it.
What about carbon monoxide detectors?
And yes, every home should have carbon monoxide detectors as well if you have a natural fuel burning appliance, like natural gas, fuel oil. If you have everything electric, all your appliances are electric, you don't need one. It's still a good idea to have one. But you certainly need to have at least one by the sleeping areas, and in the bedroom or very close to the bedroom, and then one on every level as well.
Jason Kinect, our guest fire inspector with Eau Claire Fire and Rescue, as this is the most common time of year for house fires, and there are some simple steps we can all take to prevent them. Taking your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Doug in Mount Horeb next. Doug, good afternoon.
Hi, great program.
Thank you.
I've got a suggestion to check your house for magnifying makeup mirrors and magnifying shaving mirrors, especially at this time of the year when the sun gets low on the horizon, because we have a magnifying mirror in our bathroom for that purpose, and the sun got low on the horizon and came through the window and bounced off the magnifying mirror, which then reflected all the way across the bathroom, which is about 4 feet away, onto a wooden door. And we were sitting in the living room in our house, and we thought we smelled smoke, and we walked around, and we couldn't find anything. went into the bathroom, and guess what? The inside of our bathroom door was on fire.
Whoa! That is unbelievable, and I would never have thought of that, Doug. I'm so glad you called, because that was not on my list today, Jason.
Part of my job is a fire investigator as well, and I've seen that happen 3 times over the years.
Wow!
Where it was, two of them were those mirrors where it reflected the sun down onto the wall. One was a wall, and one was actually the side of the tub. And another one was a pair of glasses that were sitting on a desk in front of the picture window, and the sun came in and refracted down and through those lenses and started the newspapers and stuff on the TV stand on fire. So yeah, it does happen. It sounds weird, but you know, it's like the kid burning ants with the magnifying glass. That's exactly how it happened.
Yeah, except it's indoors and it is a threat to everybody. And I never would have thought of that. So check your mirrors, check your very strong lenses on your glasses, and make sure those do not stay in any sort of direct rays of this sun. Great call, Doug. Yeah. And thanks so much for pointing that out. Let's go to Mike in Madison next, who has a question about firearms. Mike, good afternoon.
Hi, question about smoke alarms. So we recently had a smoky event in our kitchen from cooking, and we have interconnected smoke alarms, and they went off, which was good. But usually I could flip the circuit breaker in the panel, and they would go off, but this time it didn't.
Jason, any ideas about, my parents have the same sort of system, smoke alarms that sets them all off through the house if one goes off.
Yeah. In a residential setting now in the last 10, 15 years now, if one goes off, they all go off. They're interconnected, which runs off the house current, off the house electricity. But they still need batteries inside as a backup if the power would ever go off. So if, say, the circuit breaker does get turned off or somehow the power gets shut off to the house, they'll still work in the meantime. So those batteries still need to be changed as well. And it'll chirp just as if, just to let you know that the battery needs to be changed. So those should be changed at least every 6 months as well.
What about turning them off by switching off the fuse box and turning it back on? And in Mike's case, it did not work with his smoke alarms.
Yeah. If there's a fresh battery in there and in those detectors, it shouldn't matter if the power is turned off or not. It'll probably beep to let you know if the power is turned off.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully that doesn't happen very often where they get turned off accidentally. But
right.
The battery in them is the backup to the power.
So turning off the fuse and turning off the electricity to those smoke alarms may not have stopped the smoke alarm from setting off the alarm, because the battery would still be detecting the smoke from the kitchen.
Yep, that's the design of them anyway. Yeah, that's the theory.
What you'd hope they would be doing. Sure thing.
I would certainly hope, yeah.
Yeah. And you mentioned I watched had the opportunity to hang out at a firehouse with firefighters. They watch videos of fires to see how they grow, how they spread across a house. And the one thing that was pointed out to me was some of the newer homes seem to be a lot more flammable than the older homes. And it seems like, Jason, you were sort of alluding to some of the plastics and stuff that are used today and how quickly they can ignite.
Oh, absolutely. You know, if you picture, like, say, your parents or your grandparents' house where you had natural fibers, you had cotton, mostly was cotton and hardwoods, solid wood furniture. Nowadays, it's all synthetic stuff, polyurethane stuff, a lot of plastic. And the homes are built lighter with OSB board or press board or, you know, that sort of thing, where it's not true dimensional lumber, it's manufactured lumber, which is bad for us as firefighters, because it's great as a builder and as a homeowner because it's cheaper to build the house it's easier to build it, and you can do, you know, a lot of different design things and, you know, make it look nice. But for from my standpoint, that's great until it gets wet or hot, and then that stuff falls apart. In fact, a lot of times they don't even use nails anymore to put stuff together. A lot of the stuff is glued together, which is fine until it gets hot or wet.
Yeah, glue melts.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and I've seen the videos of it with firefighters who pointed out to me, and it really seeing the it is a little bit disconcerting when you see the world through the eyes of a firefighter, but it is what they deal with every day. Let's go to Jay in Two Rivers next. Jay, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Years ago, I was a paid on-call firefighter, so still I pay attention to news reports of fires. And they seem often to occur in the wee hours or when people are away from their homes. And I'm wondering if you have any statistics or thoughts on that.
Very interesting observation, Jay. Thank you. Jason, what do you think?
Yes, that does happen a lot, especially in the colder months where usually the coldest part of the day is about 2, 3, 4 in the morning, something like that. A lot of heating appliances work more and they work harder sometimes. When people leave the home, they should be shutting all their lights off and, you know, only keep necessary things on, maybe a night light or something. But a lot of times when people are not home, there's nobody there to discover the fire. So a lot of times it doesn't get discovered until the neighbor sees it or somebody driving by sees it. I don't have any hard statistics for you. I could maybe next time. But that is fairly common that it happens after people go to bed or right around bar time, too. You know, people will come home from the bar, maybe start making something to eat.
the pizza in the oven.
Or get distracted. Yeah, pizza in the oven, you know, that kind of stuff. That happens, very common.
Yeah, and it can be downright deadly. So it is something to consider maybe ordering out or getting it delivered as opposed to thinking you can stay alert through an entire frozen pizza. Sage advice. Hey, and one of the other tips you have, Jason, is to sleep with the doors closed. Why is that?
Yes. We tell kids in school to try to sleep with their door closed because that compartmentalizes that heat and smoke. Hmm. Really, the actual fire, the flames don't kill people. It's the chemicals and nasty stuff in the smoke. The smoke is a killer. So if you can compartmentalize that and keep that from spreading, even a real cheap hollow core door will keep all that heat and smoke out of a particular room. So if you can sleep with your door closed, and if you hear the smoke detector, you can peek out in the hallway and see if there's smoke. If there is, keep the door closed and then go out the window. But that will slow the fire down and hopefully reduce the smoke damage in the home and give us some time to get there and take care of it as well. So yeah, if you can, sleep with the door closed as much as you can.
How important is a fire escape plan for a family home, and what's the best way to help develop one with your kids without scaring them unnecessarily?
Yeah, that's a great question. Everybody should have two ways out of every room. So just go to a room and say, you know, think about, well, if I can't get out the normal way, what is the alternative? Sometimes that is the only way where there is no window or whatever and then or a different exit. But most rooms will have a window or another hallway or something to get out. So what I do or what I did when my kids were young is whenever dad would be cooking, and it seemed like it was more dad than we would use when the smoke detector would go off, we would use that as a home fire drill. Just like because they have fire drills in school.
Sure.
We'll say, okay, now let's practice this at home. And then we have a safe meeting place outside. And it's very important to know how to get out of your home, but then practice it at night. When it's dark out, that is, you know, it makes things completely different. You might know how your layout is of your furniture and stuff until at night and you stub your toe or whatever. So practice that during the day and at night. and tell the kids, you know, it's a home fire drill just like you do in school. And then revise it every so often. If, say, you buy a new couch or a new piece of furniture or something, you know, that might change the flow path or the traffic pattern in your home.
So when Dad smokes up the kitchen and sets off the fire alarm, or when Mom steams up the bathroom and sets off the fire alarm, these are perfect opportunities to practice our fire escape
Absolutely.
Plan as a family. I love that. That
yep,
really sort of justifies.
Great time to have a home fire escape plan.
Justifies your bad cooking, I think.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I did that on purpose.
Sarah from Green Bay emailed us. She says several years ago, they had a close call from a toaster. A family member put a piece of toast in the toaster, then went into the basement. Sarah woke up smelling smoke. The toaster had not ended its usual cycle, and the thick smoke permeated through the kitchen, dining room, and den. Their functioning smoke detector in the dining room and nearby living room were not triggered, and Sarah was shocked. They then learned that there are a couple types of smoke detectors. Which kind would you recommend, Jason, aside from staying in the room while using an electric appliance? What could they have done from a fire safety standpoint to have prevented this?
I'm curious as to the age of those detectors. Usually smoke detectors are only good for 10 years. And then, and yes, there's several types. There's photoionization, where it detects the products of combustion, not so much the smoke, but the products of combustion. Or a normal smoke detector, photoelectric, it's got a little beam in there, and anything that penetrates the beam, that breaks that beam, like dust or steam or smoke, will set the alarm off. But over time, they get less sensitive, and you can tell the difference between a brand new smoke detector and an older one that's probably 11 or 12, 13 years old. It takes more of that product, more of that smoke to activate it. So, like I said, smoke detectors are usually only have a lifetime of about 10 years. So
I did not consider that. And now that I'm thinking about all my smoke detectors and my parents' smoke detectors, I am thinking I don't have any smoke detectors that are younger than 10 years.
Yeah, if you take them down off the ceiling, there should be a date of manufacture on the back somewhere. It'll say a month or a year. And it's 10 years from the date of manufacture. So if it sits on a contractor shelf or a store shelf for, you know, a year, well, you only get 9 out of it.
Well, maybe when we change our clocks again this spring, we should also be checking whether or not we should be changing our smoke detectors themselves.
Absolutely. That's a great idea.
Chris emailed to ask if smoke detector placement is regulated in states or at the county level, and is there an online resource that provides this sort of information?
Yes, it's a state law for any home built after, I think it's 1998, I think it was.
Okay.
They have to be in every bedroom and within 6 feet of the bedroom, like in the bedroom hallway, and then one in every level. That's the minimum. So one in every floor of the building, including the basement, every bedroom, and then outside the bedroom hallway. And then they have to be interconnected as well. That's a state law. And that information can be found on the Department of Safety and Professional Services website. It's DSPS website. Or the National Fire Academy, or NFPA as well, the National Fire Protection Association, or your local fire department website too, I would imagine.
Yeah, you can always reach out to your local firefighters. That helping is what they do. I mean, that's
absolutely.
Yeah, that's what you love doing. And if you can prevent the next home fire, there isn't anything I think a firefighter wouldn't do in order to accomplish that. So I hope we've done our part today, Jason. You've certainly made me think in ways that I haven't thought before. Time to check the age of my smoke detectors for starters. And I hope we have this opportunity again. So thanks so much for joining.
Yes,
today.
So do I. Thank you for having me, and anytime. It's great to get the word out.
Yeah, and do some good. Jason Connect is a fire inspector with the Eau Claire Fire and Rescue. Do you know how old your smoke detectors are? Coming up next, Gavin Schmidt is an author, historian, podcaster, and he knows the story, the true story of the mafia in Milwaukee. So what do you want to know about the history of organized crime in the Cream City? That's next. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. In the most recent edition of the Milwaukee Mafia podcast, we learn about the murder of Harry Grimacki Sr., who's listed as an operator of bowling games and other amusement devices. That starts the story that takes us to the Ballastreri crime family, a story that our next guest knows too well. Gavin Schmidt is the co-host of the Milwaukee Mafia podcast. He's also the author of 10 books about Milwaukee's mafia, the most recent being The Big Safe. Look forward to getting into that. But if you have questions about the history of organized crime or its present, join our conversation. 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Gavin Schmidt, welcome to the Larry Mueller Show.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a shame that Larry's retiring, but, you know, you're doing great.
I appreciate that very much and echo your sentiment entirely. So this murder that starts your most recent podcast episode, this took place in 1974, and you've really been focusing on the mid-70s recently when it comes to your research on the mafia in Milwaukee. Why is that?
Well, I've tried to make the podcast roughly chronological.
So okay.
We've been doing this for a few years now, and we've reached that point now where we're at 74, 75. So really getting into the years that people still remember, which I think has probably caught more attention from people.
So when would you say that the mafia, which I believe you describe as Southern Italian organized crime families, when does that get its start in Milwaukee, Gavin?
It's hard to say exactly because, you know, a secret organization doesn't really publicize, but definitely firmly by 1913. But I would go so far as to say they were probably already setting up shop maybe a decade prior to that.
What's starting in 1913 that set you off?
That's just when we know they start making newspaper headlines. The head of the mob at the time would get, they didn't call him the mafia. They didn't call him head of the mafia in the newspaper because they didn't really know what that was, but they'd call him like the king of the Italian colony in Milwaukee. And so, like, I don't think that the newspaper reporters quite knew who he was, but they understood that he had a lot of say over the daily goings on in the area.
And how was it that you, Gavin Schmidt, became involved and got to know one of the family members of the Ballastreri family, which was considered one of the crime families in Milwaukee?
Well, kind of a strange story. So you're referring to John Ballastreri, who was crime boss Frank Ballastreri's son. John had reached out to my publisher and wanted to meet, and I agreed to meet. This was probably 10 years or more now, probably 2014. And we met at the Pfister Hotel, and that first conversation was a little tense. He obviously wasn't too happy with me sharing some of the stories I was sharing, but as it happened, he was working on his memoirs at the time, and he thought, well, you know, if someone's going to do it, you're the guy who should probably look them over. So I spent a fair amount of time with John editing his memoirs. Unfortunately, he passed, so I don't know if they'll ever see the light of day, but
interesting. But you talk about some of what John Ballastreri wrote, specifically about his father, Frank Ballastreri, and Frank was considered the crime boss in Milwaukee at one time. Is that right?
Absolutely. I think anybody who lived in Milwaukee from the 1960s through the 1990s would know the name Frank Ballastreri. You didn't have to be Italian or interested in crime. he was making headlines all the time. On the Senate floor in the early 1960s, he was identified as the crime boss of Milwaukee. And the newspaper used every opportunity they could to kind of reuse that quote from the Senate for the next several decades. So he was always a major figure, even if he did the smallest thing.
So what sort of crimes or vice was the Frank Balestrieri running in Milwaukee at the time? What do we know about what he was doing?
The core of any mafia family generally comes down to gambling. Okay. He's got a whole network of bookies that pay up to him during the different sports seasons, particularly basketball. So that's probably his core moneymaker. Specifically in Milwaukee, what sort of makes Frank stand out is his interest in jukeboxes, which wasn't quite as prevalent in other major cities. And he allegedly used his influence to get more and more jukeboxes in more and more places in Milwaukee, which doesn't sound like a major crime, but the key thing of that is in that era, everything was coin operated, which when your number one priority is avoiding paying taxes, the more you can do in cash, the easier it is to underreport your income. So,
well, and you may not think about it these days, but back in the day, you had cigarette vending machines that people would get their pack of smokes from.
Yes, and I think that's a key thing because in the mob world, there's what we say is, you know, things that fell off the back of the truck. And certainly cigarette trucks are known to have been hijacked. And if you hijacked a cigarette semi-truck, then put those cigarettes in a cigarette vending machine, you didn't pay for the product up front, and then you can jack up the price on the machine higher than you would get at, you know, I don't know, a grocery store or wherever. And you're getting a premium on something you didn't even pay for in the first place. So, yeah, there's a lot of money to be had that maybe, you know, a dollar here and there adds up fast.
Especially if you've got a corner on the market, as you mentioned in the latest podcast, Milwaukee Mafia podcast, Donnie Brasco actually mentions, or Joseph Pistone, who was Donnie Brasco made famous from the 1997 film, actually talks about Frank Balestrieri and his involvement with these vending machines in Milwaukee.
He does. Yep. So if you read the Donnie Brasco book, The majority of it takes place in New York, but he does have a chapter where he's in Milwaukee and he helps set up this false business where him and another FBI agent named Gail Cobb are going to move in and create a vending business with the idea that by setting one up, they're going to get threatened. They're purposely trying to get threatened. That was a major undercover operation in the late 1970s. And Joe Pistone, sometimes I give him a little flack for maybe exaggerating his role, but he absolutely was in there. He had sit-down meetings with Frank Balestrieri. He recorded some of those meetings. He boasts a little bit, but he can absolutely claim that he was right in there, met all the guys, and got some real incriminating information on them.
Now, I've heard stories of Chicago mafia actually using Wisconsin as a getaway or a place to hide away. But what are some of the other connections to some of the other areas that the Milwaukee mafia had?
Sure, absolutely. So, yes. Chicago notoriously, I mean, not just the mobsters, but Chicago in general, you know, they like going up to Door County and everywhere else. But there's a real strong link between the two mafia families, the Milwaukee Mafia and the Chicago Outfit, and directly even into the Balestrieri family themselves. Now, Frank Balestrieri's elder son, Joseph Balestrieri, his godfather was a man named Phil Eldericio, like his literal godfather at baptism. And he was in the 1970s, briefly the head of the Chicago Outfit. So it's not just, you know, the different mob families throughout the country are doing business with each other. They're kind of part of each other's literal families.
Wow.
So these links are really strong across the board.
What about the mobsters in Milwaukee, and did they connect to other hot spots like Las Vegas?
Yes. I argue that Milwaukee is probably a key piece, if not the key piece, in Las Vegas in the 1970s.
Huh.
they tend to get overshadowed by Chicago and Kansas City and other places, but the man who received loans from the Teamsters to invest in the Stardust Casino and the other casinos that were mob run in the 1970s, that man's name was Alan Glick. And Alan Glick got approved for the Teamsters loan on the say-so of Frank Balestrieri. So if Milwaukee did not okay Alan Glick, Alan Glick would never have owned the casinos in Las Vegas. So, you know, Milwaukee's always going to get overshadowed by Chicago. Again, not just in mob world, but in everything. But you cannot deny that there was an absolute linchpin piece there, on top of the fact that after Alan Glick started owning the casinos, Frank's two sons, who we've already mentioned, Joe and John, were the attorneys for Glick's corporation that ran the casinos. So They were intimately involved in the day-to-day financials from the legal standpoint.
What do we know about the mafia in Milwaukee today, Gavin?
Well, that is probably the most asked question and probably the hardest to answer. I, in my personal opinion, I don't think there is. I believe that it largely died out in the 1990s. There might still be a few stragglers, but, you know, and people have come up to me and they've told me they've seen envelopes passed over bar tops and things like that. So, is there something there? Maybe, but the violence hasn't really been a thing since the 1980s, so it's not obvious. And again, like the number one moneymaker is gambling. And now today, all we have to do is open our phones. So the market for bookies isn't quite what it used to be. We've kind of legalized everything that the mob was making money off of. So
yeah.
Is there a mob in Milwaukee? It's certainly possible, but I think if there is, it's just a shadow of whatever it was. So.
Gavin Schmidt, our guest, author, historian. He hosts the Milwaukee Mafia podcast. What questions do you have for him? Join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you are listening to The Larry Miller Show. Larry Miller returns tomorrow on The Larry Miller Show, and his guest will be Dr. Zorba Pastor. Join with your questions as Dr. Pastor provides a roadmap for a better, healthier 2026. Better and not as yet to be seen. I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Larry today, and our guest is Gavin Schmidt, historian and author. His most recent book, The Big Safe, which we'll have to get into. He also hosts the Milwaukee Mafia podcast, and also want to mention the Fox City's Murder and Mayhem podcast, which has a lot of mayhem in the most recent episodes. So I'd encourage you to check that out as well. And with all of our guests and all of the information that we provide, including our firefighting discussion in the last half hour, you can find those links after the end of the show anytime at your leisure at WPR.org/Larry, along with all the other podcasts. Or if you want to hear Larry's old shows, they're all up there for you anytime you choose. So check that out, WPR.org/Larry. So, Gavin, let's talk about your most recent book, The Big Safe, and how it relates to the organized crime families of Milwaukee.
Okay. What do you want to know?
Well, this is a sort of a violent story. We haven't really gotten into any of the violence that surrounds the Milwaukee Mafia, but this one has some murder involved.
A little bit. Yeah. It's not the focus, but it, you know, inevitably violence is sort of the mob's way of cleaning things up.
Mm-hmm.
So the Big Safe is the title is supposed to sound like a film noir. So if it sounds like an odd title, that's like the illusion I'm going for. But in the 1950s, there was a man in Reno, Nevada named Levere Redfield who was a multimillionaire but didn't believe in banks, so he kept all his money in the house. Word got out, and a boxer in Reno told his friends in Milwaukee, who happened to be mob-connected guys. They drove cross-country from Milwaukee to Reno just on this rumor, and they ended up burglarizing this man's house. And there's sort of different variations of how much money he took, but somewhere between 1.5 and 2.5 million was taken all, you know, in this house. And they didn't even find it all. Like, there was a hidden room in the basement they didn't even know was there.
With more money? That had to be one of the biggest burglaries of its time.
It was estimated to be the biggest burglary of its time. Later on, there's a more famous case of a Brinks truck getting robbed. That was a bigger deal. But up to that point, yes. And if you adjust for inflation, $1 or $2 million in the 1950s in today's money, I don't have that exact number, but it's even more than it sounds. It's a lot.
Let's go to your questions now at 1-800-642-1234. We'll start with Tom and Ripon. Tom, good afternoon.
Hi, how you doing, Larry?
Good. What do you have for us today?
I'm just wondering about, I'm from Finlac originally, and there's always rumors and innuendos of, mafia infiltrating the cheese companies around Finlac. I don't want to say what cheese companies there were, but there was a... It was kind of not so well-kept secret that the mafia ran these cheese companies, including, putting muscle on little cheese factories outside of Farm Lac. And one occasion I've heard that one little cheese farmer or whatever had a cheese factory outside of Farm Lac went missing and they never found them. Wonder if if you know anything about that.
Tom, that is a great question. And the first time I heard about the Milwaukee Mafia was working at a pizza joint in Madison, my first job in the mid-90s. And interestingly enough, in the last few minutes of your most recent Milwaukee Mafia podcast, you make mention of pizza, Gavin. So I'm wondering what you make of Tom's story.
I'm familiar with Tom's story. I appreciate him not actually mentioning any company name.
As do we.
The company name that he's probably referring to still exists. So I try to, for legal reasons, I try to not say that name. But yes, there is a long history of mob involvement in Wisconsin's cheese going back at least to 1940, if not earlier. It was born out of a Chicago businessman who came up to Fond du Lac and started the company, and they ended up having a minor war over ownership. There were three or four guys who were killed over ownership. The guys who took over the company after that had connections to the Bonanno Mafia in New York. Mm. And then as late as the 1960s, 1970s, the father-son, again, I'm going to try to avoid using names, the father-son duo that owned this particular company was always listed on the FBI's list of known mafia members. So it's more than a rumor. They've definitely been looking into that for a long time. And yes, there's definitely evidence of them pushing out smaller cheese companies. I believe we did a podcast episode of one rival cheese company where the owner was found dead in his car, and officially it was ruled a suicide, but the man's wife, this is a man named Summers, the man's wife actually pushed for an investigation because she believed that this other company had basically pushed him out by, you know, making it look like he had asphyxiated himself.
Wow. Organized cheese. And it's interesting, the latest Thomas Pynchon book that had loosely based on Milwaukee Mafia refers to the crime leader as, I believe, the Al Capone of counterfeit cheese. So it continues to make it into the fictional world as well, but there is a factual story that is to be told. It sounds like the Fond du Lac cheese wars. Let's go to Irene in Janesville next. Irene, good afternoon. You're on with Gavin Schmidt.
Oh, terrific. I'm very excited about this. And I wondered if you could tell me about other legislative or police or law enforcement or politicians who were involved with the mafia, either in Milwaukee or elsewhere.
Ooh. Okay.
Ooh. Gavin, how would you like to answer that?
Well, this is where I usually give Milwaukee a lot of credit. again, comparing them to Chicago, Chicago notoriously had judges bought off. There was a few famous investigations in Chicago, one called Operation Greylord, where they found that judges were literally taking bribes to let murderers go. And we don't really see parallels like that in Milwaukee. Like, there's some low level stuff. We see vice cops kind of looking the other way for a bottle of wine. We see there was a judge named Chris Serafim who was caught going on vacation in Hot Springs, Arkansas with some of the bookies, but there was no proof that he did anything wrong, that he just happened to know them. The mayor of Milwaukee famously for decades denied that there was organized crime in Milwaukee, and people always kind of wondered why he denied it when everybody else knew it was there. But relatively speaking, as far as corrupt law enforcement and politicians go, Milwaukee is clean. I guess I can't say that today. I don't know. But over the extent of the mafia years, it was always very minor. Like, there's an isolated incident here or there where there was a man named Max Adonis who wanted to injure another man, and he was able to get a police detective to release a photo of the man so that he could pass the photo around saying that that man's life was in danger. But like, that's the extent of it. He didn't get the officer to do anything, like do the violence. He basically just got him to release a mugshot, which is pretty minor on the grand scheme of things. So,
but also kind of fitting with what the general assumption would have been about Chicago politics versus Wisconsin politics, that there was sort of a divide there that was more than just the borderline. I have an email from Cheryl in Superior who points out that Jimmy Hoffa's body has never been found. Cheryl had a college roommate that thought he was in one of the lakes in Upper Michigan. Any comment on that, Gavin?
Who knows? I don't know if she's familiar, but just in the last year or two, they used ground penetrating radar to see if he was under the old county stadium in Milwaukee.
Oh,
like, so the talk of him being in Wisconsin, like, that's generally we think that he's somewhere farther east, but it does come up. He did have Jimmy Hoffa did have a lodge up in Eagle River, so he clearly does have the Wisconsin connections. But I don't know more than anyone else does where he is.
Jim in Middleton emailed to ask about the story of Isidore Pogrobe.
Okay.
Are you familiar?
Yes. So he ran a bar / strip club called the Brass Rail. This would have been 1960, and one night he's leaving, he gets forced into a car, brought out to Mequon, is shot in the head and dumped in a culvert just outside of Mequon. And they never solved it. As with most mob murders, they never solved it. But by sheer coincidence, who takes over the Brass Rail after his death? Frank Balestrieri. So definitely seems like there's a connection there. The suspicion was always that Izzy was getting hijacked liquor, getting his liquor cheap, but wasn't paying his bills on that. So, again, who knows? Officially, it's unsolved, but there's definitely more than a few links tracing back to Frank on that one.
It reminds me of going back to your relationship with Frank's son, John Balestrieri, that you had up until his passing at the age of 75 a few years ago. The three most dreaded words that he would ever hear from his dad. Got him in it? So it sounded like Frank was kind of a scary guy, and maybe John was intimidating as well to begin with. Do you think that the Balestrieri story will ever be able to be told through you, Gavin?
Like John's story?
Yeah. Well, wherever his biography lies today.
I really hope so. So that I have the manuscript. The manuscript is... it needs some editing, but it's definitely, it's A to Z complete. The real hurdle right now is I'm not exactly sure legally what I can do with it because the author does not live. So that's a bit of a hurdle, but if I can figure out a way around that, I'd love to see it published, because John's stories, and they're not just mob stories. I mean, he knew all kinds of famous musicians. He set up a theme park in Italy based on the Renaissance.
Gavin, yes, I apologize. We're out of time, but we'll have to keep up with you on the Milwaukee Mafia podcast, the Fox City's Murder and Mayhem podcast, and your latest book, and hopefully we can have you back again. Thank you, Gavin.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. And thanks as well to our team today, Clara Neipert, Joel Patinaw, Jeff Robbins, Brad Kohlberg, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. Larry Mueller returns tomorrow with Dr. Zorba Pastor as his guest. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to WPR News.